And then we put forward an accusation of the same, and we're just met with balls all over. no forward movement. Yeah, I would be mad. I mean, I'd be super mad. I'd be so mad I might even consider going to a God-hating communist rag like the Washington Post.
Welcome to the Stand Firm podcast. We're recording this episode on Wednesday, November 12th, 2025. I'm Nick Lannon of Grace Anglican Church in Louisville, Kentucky, and I'm here with Matt Kennedy of the Anglican Church of the Good Shepherd in Binghamton, New York, and J.D. Koch of Holy Trinity Parish in Hillsdale, Michigan. Guys, how are you doing today?
Great. How are you?
Good, Nick. Thanks.
I'm hanging in there. We did have a brief flurry of snow, but I think you guys both got real snows, right?
Just enough to make it look pretty, but not really. Just like
I don't know. I'm frightened. We got like a foot, and we realized immediately how unprepared we are. I'm grateful it only lasted about 36 hours, the cold, but I ran to Walmart and Meijer and every place in between and bought every piece
every
of
jacket
weather clothing
place.
I could find. Not for me. I was pretty much okay. But, you know, I've got these seven little kids and they don't have any self-protective wisdom yet. And so just a lot of crying and hands getting cold. And It was, I don't know, we're going to be all right. We're going to be all right. It's the ice, really, I've decided. That's what's really frightening. The older I get, I have a lot more sympathy for the people who said I can't come to early morning Bible study because of the ice. And I just had no real sympathy. I mean, I didn't berate them or anything, but now I understand. It's like one icy patch and your entire, like, you know, late 40s, early 50s are consumed with PT and, you know, reconstructive therapy or something. So anyway, people have survived here for a long time before I got here, so I'm assuming that we'll learn quickly.
Only the strong.
I want all my cold weather gear back, Matt. I want it all. I want it. It's just,
I'm enjoying your discomfort. This is a very happy day for me.
Yeah. It's the Lord's irony. It's just like I was on a Zoom call with the bishop. They did the like rector's check-ins or whatever that they do in our diocese, and I said, this is the first time I've worn socks other than Sunday for the past 10 years of my life. I mean, this is what's really happening. But here we are. But yeah, I'm not complaining. It's been great. It's just been learn how to.
Sounds like you're complaining to me. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. You know, I don't want to grumble. I don't want the snakes to come out. So I gotta.
Just because you're living in the Revenant doesn't mean that.
That's right. I haven't attacked a bear yet, but I have been tempted to eat some liver, raw liver. So just to keep my glucose levels up. But at any rate, I know it's a great irony and it's a laughter now, but there we have it. But it's no, it's fine. We're having a good time. We figured out how to build an igloo and things like that.
There you go.
So, nice. That's right.
Well, you guys, heavy times continue for the ACNA. Since we last recorded, the Living Church published an article detailing an update of the presentment of Archbishop Wood, including accusations from another woman. Perhaps most surprisingly, though, was a cover letter from the people putting forth the original presentment, I think, that they had not, in fact, gone first to the Washington Post, as we assumed when we recorded last week, because that's what we'd been told by ACNA leadership, but that they had, in fact, tried for months to get their presentment through the proper channels. Kendall Harmon, among others, has questioned the integrity of the systems we have in place for dealing with these things, especially when they involve bishops. Everyone is going to be watching this Title IV revision process very carefully, as if they weren't already. And of course, there's still the Jones mess and the Ruck mess, which hopefully, blessedly, may be itself over in a month or so. So guys, what kind of mess are we in? Is it a canonical mess? Is it a crisis of confidence mess? Is it a leadership mess? What kind of mess are we in? And then how can we get out of it?
To your first question, yes. all of those messes are in play. And I think part of it is, you know, what was revealed in the cover letter and what's been revealed about the case with Bishop Jones is that there seems to be just a pattern of, if you're making an accusation against a bishop, you're going to have a hard time having any air at all, any oxygen at all. It took these people almost a year to get just to get to the point where it would be investigated. And it probably, who knows if it ever would have, if the Washington Post hadn't been involved. So in that, you know, when you look at the way that that was handled, at least allegedly, according to the cover letter and according to the letter from the seven chaplains about Jones, it was a leadership failure in the first part, a personal leadership failure on the part of bishops who would hear these accusations and just pretty much try to shut them up. And then secondly, it was a canonical problem. Yeah, of course. I mean, the canons, but I'm not sure. I don't think the canonical problem is the biggest problem, because no matter how good your laws are, if you got people who are at the top who don't want things to be heard or things to come out, they're going to use the canons the way they want to use the canons. And that's the problem, right? So maybe the new revisions will make it so that that's really is something that's impossible. I don't know. Hopefully so. But I still think laws are only as good as the men and women who live under them. If you decide to be a scofflaw, you'll be a scofflaw.
One of the ways I've heard this described is that the canons, and many have said this, is that the original ACNA constitution and canons were explicitly kept very simple and short on purpose. And so the canons are clear, but the procedures and policies that sort of would undergird them are not written down. So what you have to do to conform to the canon is less clear. And this Title IV revision, as I understand it, is an attempt to canonize, if you will, some of the procedures that you have to follow, which is why they're like 20 times longer, because now the actual procedures are in the canons as well as just the rule itself.
Well, you know, the law is for the unrighteous, not the righteous. So that's, I mean, I think the original idea was, well, we don't have to have a lot of detail here, because we're going to be just and fair with one another. We're not like the Episcopal churches. And if that were the case, yeah, fine. But obviously it's not. So we need these revisions to be really, really detailed and written in a way that's going to make it possible for accusations to be heard. I mean, I read another article this morning by, I forget his name, but he was talking about it's really important at the same time to not dispense with the procedural rules that are given to protect the accused too. You don't want to just turn into a place where anyone can make an accusation and it's necessarily assumed to be true. But the people who are making accusations need to be able to be heard and protected against retribution and not slandered or taken down in some kind of defensive way. So I guess the old assumption about who we were going to be in the ACNA is wrong. And so we have to have better laws and more detailed laws.
Well, does that beg the question? I know that's not the proper use of that phrase, but it's the only one that I know. Was ACNA 2 right all along?
No. I mean, this is the thing. ACNA 2 is, at their inception, the woman, Joanna, I forgot her last name, but she posted on Twitter that her aim was to take down the ACNA. That was her purpose and point. And the glee with which people in that organization reported on various things made that aim apparent. And on top of that, the coming out as affirming, I don't think anyone should trust anybody who is that morally blind. I think that the actual victims in the Ruck case need all of our sympathy and our help and everything that we can give them, but they deserve to be represented by an organization that's not going to use their pain to wedge in, for lack of a better word, woke ideology into the ACNA, which is what ACNA 2 is. Why would a victims advocacy group need to make an affirmation statement about gay sex? Why would you need to do that? If you're caring about the victims of abuse, that's your focus, not on whether or not not on queer theory. So I just didn't understand why that would be the case. So no, I think ACNA 2 could have made some correct points had they not engaged in of the political and ideological warfare they engaged in. But those points could have been made by are being made now and by these people, which is very great. And they could have been made then by another group, which you might believe, you remember them, Believe Us Too. They were along to oppose ACNA too, and they also made similar observations about the need to protect victims and enable their words to be heard and their charges and their accusations to see the light.
I just can't help. There are a couple of things. I mean, you know, notwithstanding the specifics of the any individual case, the sad part for me, well, there's a couple of things. One, I think that however clear or unclear our canons are, that the catch-all now of spiritual abuse that's being levied at the very least at Bishop Jones and Bishop Wood, I mean, again, notwithstanding the sexual allegation, you know, that encompasses such a broad, undefined category that it's terrifying to a certain degree to think that in the context of a long ministry, again, I'm not speaking now about any, I'm talking about going forward, right? Going forward at the very least, in the context of a long, long ministry, that given the complexity and the challenges of dealing with in some cases horrific situations like the ones that was with Rivera or whatever his name was, and attempting to in the fog of war to manage all of the various sides, that somehow you could get through that without inadvertently or even perhaps unknowingly or both offending someone or not being pastoral enough or overstating or understating or having a bad day or whatever the case may be, and that in that event, which is almost guaranteed to happen when people's emotions and lives are deeply affected as they are in the context of trauma and challenge, that they're the first recourse, it seems to be, is going to be some sort of legal salvo through a bishop, you know, that so just wait for, it's like the, you know, it's like I think about those baseball movies where after every game, you whether or not you have like a pink slip on your locker or something. It's like, and I'm not saying, I'm not personally, you know, expecting that exactly, but at the same time, if this is normalized as the way that we actually communicate, firstly, with respect to even righteous offense, then there's a, it's just a further indication of just such a lack of trust and genuine Christian compassion and understanding amongst fallen people working towards the same ends. Now, again, that's not a statement on any of the particulars of any of these three cases. I'm just talking about going forward, because if what is normalized in our canons is that the whatever, I mean, whatever offense is taken, I mean, again, I can't, it's not surprising to me that people are offended by all sorts of things that I personally wouldn't be, or things that I'm offended by that other people aren't. And if that is now consonant with or at the same level of something that is prohibitable or actionable in terms of a ecclesial trial, you know, where did they, I mean, I'm just trying to think. I keep thinking through this, like, what if one of you are accused of these things? I mean, or you can think about it for me, you know, what would you do? I mean, if I ever heard an accusation that seemed credible or was meaningful in any way, the first person I'd call would be you. Like, I don't know if I would have been then violating all of our new canons that are like, you know, subsection 19 versus 52 or whatever. But the first thing I would want you to do is call me and be like, hey, this is a hard conversation, but like so-and-so said, you said such and such or did X, Y, and Z. What do you, is that true? And I would either say like, oh my gosh, no, you know, absolutely not. I was in New Orleans when that supposedly happened or whatever, you know, have an alibi. Or I would say, oh my gosh, well, here's what happened. And I would explain the situation and you would say, well, that's not their perspective of it. And that would then be the process by which Christian people would begin to work it out, possibly to the end where you say, well, I love you, but like that was a real error in judgment. And I'm going to have to, you know, we're going to have to figure out how to get you a good job at the local car dealership here in Binghamton, because like, I'm not sure you should be a minister anymore. But instead, what we have now is a system that I think is just a reflection of where we have been, it turns out, as a province for a good number of years now. And this was a surprise to me, because we weren't, Nick and I weren't in the ACNA for its first, what, 9 years of
Yeah.
existence. And so I did have some rose colored glasses, I guess, from the outside, because I assume that in many ways, at the very least, a sense of camaraderie, trust, and genuine Christian conviction would be shared despite our churchmanship differences, despite all the things. And it was a real shock to me to enter into the ACNA and to realize that some of these disagreements had festered and sort of turned septic almost to the point where, like, it was as divisive, or at least it was rancorous under, you know, 2 or 3 inches down as any division we had in the Episcopal Church. And that was having worked as like the only rector in the entire diocese that wouldn't do same-sex weddings. And I still was not aware of some of the same sort of acrimony about, you know, about all the issues we've talked about the whole time, you know, churchmanship, charismatic high church, low church, women's ordination, what you name it. And again, I don't know how to fix that exactly, except to go back, as we've said, to first principles over and over again and say, listen, you know, you can, there are a lot of other churches out there, but like, this is how we were founded. This is what we were founded for. These are some of the compromises we made. And if you don't see across the aisle people that are genuinely for you, even if they have some substantial disagreements about these things, well, then don't be surprised that when you find the opportunity to glory in their shame, that you're gonna take it. And I'm not saying, again, I'm not speaking specifically about any of these other than just the general tenor of the conversation that has unfolded, because we should be just weeping for our perhaps our fallen leaders, you know, perhaps the ones that we you know, we had hoped more, you know. I mean, like the road to Emmaus, you know, people like the, you know, we had placed all our hope in him. You know, maybe that was unfounded, or it was misguided, or perhaps even an error. But I have been so disheartened by the sort of self-righteous indignation concerning the sort of the glory and the downfall of some of these men, rightly or wrongly. Again, I don't know the specifics of it. That's been the biggest takeaway for me, is like, you know, I'd like to think that there would be people weeping along with me in my you know, mistakes, or perhaps just outright blindness, that even, you know, that were adjudicated in a way that brought reconciliation or recompense to the victim, whatever the case may be. I don't know. And that's my 50,000 foot lament.
I hear you. And I think you're right about the bleed over from this person tried to assault me sexually to this person said things that made me, my feelings hurt. But that's why I point to groups like ACNA too as being unreliable people to take your cue on how to deal with victims from, because that's what they do. They would love for me to be disciplined for calling them heretics because they're affirming. They would love that kind of language to be worthy of censure. They say that quite often. In fact, this person's not associated with ACNA too, but I was told that I abused this one person because she came on the unofficial Facebook page and called rectors and pastors who had lost their building during the Episcopal Church fight, essentially grievance mongers. And I told her, you need to apologize. And she said, and she didn't apologize. So I said, all right, well, I'm going to ban you then. And I banned her. And then she screenshotted all that, put it on Twitter, and it's abuse. I've abused her. And I'm sorry, that's not abuse. And we do need to be safeguard against you hurt my feelings, therefore, or
well,
you.
Well, now that you mention it, Matt, this is an awkward time to bring this up, but Nick and I have been meaning to talk to you. So
we have 10 signatures of random priests from across the province.
Well, like, so for what, like our revisions of the disciplinary canons in our diocese, make it clear what kind of,
yeah,
speech is appropriate and what's not. And if it's not that a priest couldn't be disciplined for what he says, but that discipline has to be grounded in biblical principles rather than just kind of subjective, I felt this way when you said that to me type accusations. So,
and I do think that there's some protections built in to our existing canons that will be strengthened in the Title IV revision. That's why you have to have multiple clergy sign off on a presentment. You can't just on your own declare that your feelings are hurt and therefore present a member of the clergy. And also, I believe it's not in our current canon, but I think it is in the revision that the pastoral abuse has to be repetitive and to a certain level. It can't be one slip up. It has to be ongoing and severe.
It doesn't
Yeah.
serve the actual victims of real
Yeah.
sexual abuse or physical abuse well to liken what they have endured to someone having their feelings hurt because of a conversation they've had. That doesn't help the situation we're trying to alleviate and stop all kinds of sexual inappropriateness in the church.
As clergy, I think that the three of us and clergy like us can see these things and get understandably skittish about what if I say the wrong thing? What if I offend somebody? What if I act in a way that is misinterpreted? Am I going to be brought up on charges for that and have my life and ministry ruined? And at least in the Diocese of Christ Our Hope, and I'm sure that's true of your diocese as well, most times that uncomfortable or misinterpreted things get sent up the chain, they're looked at and sent away and they're never heard of. So there is a sense in which clergy are protected from spurious allegations, at least in theory. But that we have to have the systems in place, as you were saying, Matt, that when something really does happen, we have to be able to handle it.
Yeah, and I think it was, it goes both ways. I mean, I would like to think that if I were persisting in some sort of recognizably offensible thing, that somebody who cares about me, loves me, like for instance a bishop or a friend like y'all, would at the very least, if they particularly receive a complaint, would process it and approach me with it again and say, hey, here's seems to be some problem or an issue, or like, let's talk. I mean, again, and we've had that conversation. I mean, if you have friends for a long time,
Yeah.
you have that conversation. And I think, again, that points back to my deep-seated concern, which is that level of trust and collegiality and sort of Christian brotherhood, I mean, amongst the bishops, at least seems to be lacking, or at least it failed, and when it needed to happen, pull you aside and say, hey, this isn't this was this is if this persists in this direction, this is a bad situation. I mean, that's and then, I'm thinking about it as these older men. I mean, I'm not a young man, but I'm thinking, like some conversations as a younger man that I've had that have redirected me, and even as middle-aged redirected me. And I'm saying, we are in a redemptive business where people do mature and grow. And the idea that anyway, I don't know what I'm saying other than it's just deeply saddening. Of course, the specifics of the allegation, particularly against Bishop Wood with respect to the Mrs. Buxton, are that's a serious allegation, and that needs to be taken. I mean, that's not really what I mean.
Yeah.
That's of a different category,
Right.
in my mind, what I'm thinking going
In that
forward,
case,
because that's
one time is enough.
well, sure. I mean, I think that's where you're like, well, you need to walk that out. We talked about that last week. That needs to be taken seriously and moved up the chain, however that plays out. But it's the litany of the other things, like even with Bishop Ruck. Like, I mean, as we've talked about 6 years ago, like when did it come out, or whenever it said, to the extent that there's any good news, just as this side of heaven, the man that was the most egregious in his crimes is in prison. I mean, like, again, that doesn't take away the offense. There's only so much of our human justice this side of heaven, but like there is the system, to the extent that the evil perpetrator was tried and put in prison, worked in that respect. And so, a lot of the other claims about Bishop Ruck, and again, I mean, we've read them now for years, rise to the level of perhaps serious mismanagement, perhaps fraternal indifference to family members, or whatever the case may be. But at the end of the day, that he himself is not being accused of any of these specific crimes, and yet the way that people talk about him, and the way that this entire trial of Bishop Ruck is being painted, is almost as if he's the one that's on the on the hook for actually like not just perpetrating these crimes, but somehow being aware of them and then indifferent to it. And I think that's, you know, I know people who are in his diocese or in his church, you know, and again, I don't know him personally, but I mean, that's just the next step, a step I'm not willing to take with respect to a Christian minister who's been elevated in our church to a position like that, to say, well, at a fundamental level, there's a character and deeply anti-Christian flaw here that deserves this type of punishment, because, you know, oversight and confusion and the complexities of accusations against people that you know and could want to think the best of, and all the various things are you could be wrong about all of that, and yet you could still be a faithful minister and a good, and in fact, a good bishop, maybe not a good administrator. Again, I'm not defending Bishop Ruck exactly. I'm just talking about.
When you get to the bishop office of bishop, I mean, that's a lot of responsibility, a lot of corporate responsibility, right? So judgment failures are they're on a different level, right? You could really hurt a lot of people by making irresponsible judgment calls. And from, I mean, I'm not his on his jury. I'm not gonna pronounce any guilt. I don't know, but I mean, if the circumstances are what they seem, and he let people into his diocese as ministers who were had past records of abuse, I mean, that's I don't see how that can be just a slap on the wrist. I think that's a pretty serious charge that, if true, could and probably should, I think it should have some serious consequences, up into maybe even losing his office. Not that he's a terrible man. It's just that when it's like a captain of a ship, like if you using the analogy last time, if you run the ship aground, even if you're not at the seat driving the thing, you're still responsible as the captain. And so the office of bishop is one of supreme responsibility in our church, as is the archbishop, obviously.
Right.
So if under your watch you made decisions which enable abusers to abuse, or put people in danger of being abused, I think that's, you know, you should step down at that point. I'm not saying you did that purposefully. I would never think that Bishop Ruck would ever do that purposefully, but because I mean I think he believes. My guess is, because he's really strong and charismatic, he had certain beliefs about the restoration of these people. But there's consequences for that. We'll see what the jury says or the trial court says, but I think need to be.
Well, I agree with you there. I do think that there is a, I think, again, and not speaking specifically of Bishop Ruck, but I think in the event that you as the captain, even using your best judgment, turns out that, and despite all appearances otherwise, the person you appointed to say drive the ship wrecked it, that, you know, someone at the height of responsibility should take responsibility for that, even if directly it wasn't your intent or expectation. So I could see that as an argument, but again, that's even a solution, or at least a scenario that would seem to require a level of collegiality and trust amongst, you know, clergy and bishops that we're lacking, I would say, because, you know, putting your arm around someone and walking them and saying, hey, you know, this is hard as it is for me as it is for you, but given the situation, looks like we're going to have to, you know, would it be best for you to step down, is a conversation that you can hear, you know, as hard as it would be from someone that, you know, genuinely loves and cares about you and that you have a sense of trust and collegiality with. And I think that, you know, again, you can point to the speed at which the ACNA was put together. You can look at the sort of different formations of the various people that came into it. You can look at the expectations even. And I'm not just talking about bishops now. I'm talking about like rectors down to lay people. And you can see this sort of shifting sand of what is our shared foundation? What are we actually united by, other than, as we talked about a couple of weeks ago, like this sort of vague appeal to the liturgy and, you know, embodiment or holistic worship or whatever it is that the catchphrase is, that doesn't seem like it's strong enough to hold up against legitimate mistakes and even outright offense, which any of these three trials contain perhaps a mixture, an admixture of both. right? And so, again, I mean, I don't know what to do. I mean, it's been hard for me because you just start focusing in on your local parish at this point to a certain degree and say, well, let's keep short accounts and pray for, honest communication and faithful Christian confession and Lord have mercy. But going forward, I'm not exactly sure what has to happen, but I do think that on the other side of this, we're going to have had to be, we're being forced with a dramatic rethink of the not just the procedures, but the actual uniting and sort of, I mean, the shared foundation and convictions.
It seems like the Jones situation is a perfect illustration of what you're talking about, where the idea of a presentment is that your brother bishops come alongside you, put their arm around you, like you said in your vision, and say, maybe you should step aside for your own health, for the health of the church. And it seems like in the Jones situation, he wasn't able to hear that in any kind of brotherly love. It was, you all are woke and you're after me because I'm a real conservative. And so that's sort of the illustration of that like
Right.
pre-existing breakdown of relationship that you're describing.
Yeah, and I do think that's also a factor of the kind of litigious kind of culture and environment we find ourselves in, church or not, in the sense that, any admission of wrongdoing or weakness or culpability at all, opens yourself up to, well, attacks, maybe a strong word, but at the very least, remorseless condemnation, without any hope for redemption. And I think that, because theoretically, what I mean, Bishop Jones, at least we watched his whole video, and he, defended himself through this, and so he, at a certain sense, felt like he had explained himself. And so perhaps had he waited around for the presentment to come, that would have been sufficient. I don't know. That would have been. I mean, I know that a lot of people would have liked to have seen how that would have played out, but to your point, Nick, there was no sense of trust that he had that the presentment would be handled in any way other than, by the woke, what do you call it, the woke or whatever. So I don't know really how to process all of it, honestly, other than I know that on both sides of all of these presentments and arguments are genuinely hurting people who feel perhaps rightly righteous in their own eyes to a certain degree, and we're not a giant corporation with HR, lawyer experts with severance packages and all the things that come with dealing with disgruntled employees and overreaching bosses and all the things. We're a church, and I just don't, the idea that we are devolving into a more administrative kind of lawfare system is sad. I mean, I don't know if it's frightening exactly. I mean, the law is to the unrighteous, not the righteous, but at the same time, like, I mean, it, but of course I do feel like if you were someone whose friend or God forbid child or someone had been, allegedly victimized or not treated appropriately, and you were sitting around waiting for months, years in the event of finding some reconciliation, that would also be horrible and dispiriting. And so it's a, at the moment, it's like a lose-lose situation, but the Lord makes a way where there is no way, right? So just pray. I mean, legitimately have been praying more specifically for all involved, and that there would be something of a graceful, albeit painful, for some, if not all involved, resolution on the other side of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really helpful to think about in those terms. Like, if someone, if some bishop or priest tried to, make moves on Anne or one of my children, I mean, and then we put forward an accusation of the same, and we're just met with walls all over, no forward movement. Yeah, I would be mad. I mean, I'd be super mad. I'd be so mad I might even consider going to a God-hating communist rag like the Washington Post because it's unjust. It's fundamentally unjust, And so I think you're right to be worried about the litigiousness of our church now, because shellacked on top of the fact that we're all sinners, and so these kind of things are going to happen in the church is the ideological and theological divides that are there, which will bring which will and already have caused people to use this legal system as a means of warfare. Because we're so divided, I think, JD, you're right, that's going to happen. I don't know how to stop it from happening, except to have a legal system so clear and well-oiled, I guess, that ulterior motives in bringing accusations, or if a person has ulterior motives in bringing forth an accusation, that will be known, understood. The accusation will be judged on its own merit, not on the basis of whether the person hearing the accusation or people hearing the accusation agree or disagree with the theology of, or the ideology of the person bringing it, or the motives of the person bringing it. So it's got, we do have to have a blind legal system. And what these cases so far have shown us is that we have nothing close to resembling a blind system. I mean, if you're reporting an accusation against the archbishop, and the person receiving the accusation and processing it works for the archbishop, and the archbishop chooses the BOI for the investigation against himself, I mean, that's absurd. That's patently, you've got to have, I don't know what to do, but should we create an independent judiciary like we have in the three branches of the U.S. government? So there's no.
Well, that's theoretically the point of the dean of the province, right? That's supposed to be his role, right?
I mean, I don't know. Maybe under the new canons, I don't know. But it seemed like from what I was reading from the cover letter that in the Washington Post, that the Archbishop's office was handling the presentment to get the Archbishop. Maybe I'm misreading that, but that's what I understood.
Well, I still think that, this goes back to years and years ago. We were talking about this, the type sort of accusations that were flying about harm and victims and things in the broader culture. And to your point back then, Matt, which I still agree with, is that the sort of maximal semantic use of the word harm actually ironically harms those who have been legitimately harmed, and I think that some sort of clarity, which I'm grateful in our diocese we do have about what constitutes actionable, presentable offense, and of course I would rightly put accusations of sexual harassment right at the top of that list. I mean, I think that's what the whole safeguarding thing. I mean, we're like we have to do that, and I'm happy to be a part of, a church that, I mean, with for myself and my family, I'm grateful that that's part of our obligations to keep people safe. But I do think that, beyond, not beyond that, I mean, but beyond sort of clear, objectifiable, egregious transgressions of clear violations, or clear standards, then this opening up of, whether it's spiritual abuse or, what was this, Archbishop Wood was the offhand comment about the how expensive his truck was or something. I mean, things like this just devolves so quickly into what otherwise in any other time in my life I would have simply described as petty grievances, I mean, sort of like hurt feelings or disagreements of personalities or whatever the case may be. And yet now here we are, looking at these three men on trial. Again, there's the specifics are not even really the point at this point. They're all it's all over but the shouting with respect to, we're not involved in the, at least I'm not involved in any of the courts or the adjudication. So, I mean, I'm just reading what everyone else is reading, but I just think about going forward, what it like, what do we, how do we repair the trust? How do we establish it? How do we legitimately talk to our fellow clergy and then future bishops about problems that they may have that we want that they should address, we should be ministers to, and then how do we, lovingly not hold them accountable in a, like a grim reaper sort of way, but lovingly challenge everyone who's assumed these levels of leadership to walk in a way worthy of the calling. I mean, I don't know, I don't, but that's what you you hope this all of this collegiality, what a church, college of bishops, and a diocese and fellow clergy would be a part of. And we have glimpses of it. I mean, I'm thankful for you two guys and Liza and friends, who actually know and see and walk with us and sort of, are part of the conversation. But when all of the human realities of a sinner in the midst of redemption become launching pads for further fighting talking points, online or elsewhere, it's disheartening and dispiriting. And I think I don't know how to fix that. I mean, maybe I'm part of the problem. I don't know, but there we have it. Lord have mercy.
Well, maybe not the most bright and shining note to end on, but it is going to be the note that we have to end on this week. We are out of time. Thanks for listening to Stand Firm. If you want to keep the conversation going, please be in touch. Rate and review the podcast on iTunes and send us an email at mailbag@standfirminfaith.com or join the Anglicans for the Gospel Facebook group. Thanks to JD Koch and Matt Kennedy, as always. I'm Nick Lannon, and Lord willing, we'll be back next week. Until then, by the grace of God and Jesus Christ, we'll be standing firm.